This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Families have a lot going on. Let Ollie help manage the mental load with new cognitive health supplements for everyone 4 and up, like delicious Ollie Focus Pops or Ollie Mellow Pops for kids. And for parents, try 3 new Brainy Chews to help you focus, chill out, or get energized. Find these cognitive health buddies for the whole fam at Ollie.com. That's Olly.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
There's some really fascinating ideas about how dead bodies are actually quite a safe people to interact with, because there's no danger of rejection, there's no danger of pain, there's no danger of abuse, that kind of thing.
Somebody told me a few weeks ago that they missed some of the darker, edgier topics on the Edge with Andrew Gold podcast. So I'm pleased and a little apprehensive to bring you today's episode on some of the darkest and most taboo topics on Earth, namely bestiality or bestiality, cannibalism, necrophilia and incest. James Williams is an anthropologist and speaker who I found out about from Matt at Bristol Humanists, where I did a talk about journalism and objectivity as it happens. Anyway, I'm so happy that Matt put me in touch with James because this episode blew my mind. I do think it might be too much for some people, and I'd advise you to just skip and go to the next one if that's the case. I do understand that, and a lot of this stuff is very, for lack of a better word, triggering. We really delve into some of the murkiest subjects imaginable, but know that we're not doing it just for shock. James is a skeptic, which I think in this case means he is interested in looking at the facts and the science and seeing what we can learn away from the emotion and revulsion of any particular topic. So much of what James said was surprising and elucidating, really educational, as he talks about things like the modern European cannibalistic cultures, the necrophiliacs in nature, and how bestiality plays such an important role in our evolution. Incest is the one he is currently investigating, so we cover that quite quickly at the start because he's still researching that, but get into some really fascinating stuff as we go on. Thank you, James, for coming on. If you want to get in touch with him about these talks, to get him to talk at your place of work or whatever it might be, he does these great talks, or just if you just want to say hi, send him an email on cannibalskeptic@gmail.com. Skeptic is spelled with a K there. Cannibalskeptic@gmail.com. You get it. I really do hope you guys aren't too grossed out and that you enjoy this chat and get something from it. I certainly did. Coming up are war refugee Mustafa Kazemi, communist professor Dr. Asatar Bear, so we'll have a big debate about communism, and behaviour analyst Rory Sutherland. But for now, here's James Williams. It's really exciting, actually. When Matt from Bristol Humanist told me about you, I was like, what? Nobody does these kinds of talks. I've never heard anything like this. So I guess tell me a bit about what you do and the talks you give.
Yeah, I am fascinated by the macabre and the arcane and the unusual. I started out researching cannibalism as part of my university degree, and really found it fascinating, ended up doing my dissertation on a cannibalistic subject. And then since then, I've just been sort of searching for these topics that are taboo and writing and performing talks about taboo topics. And it's led me to the trilogy, I think, which is cannibalism, necrophilia, and bestiality. And I've now done quite a lot of research into all these things and have some talks that I'm pretty proud of.
That's cool. So they're like the three. And I know that you were saying in your email that incest is like the next one. It seems that you're fascinated by revulsion as well. And I mean, I, I, I know a bit about that myself from having I've been investigating pedophilia for like the same reason, I think, like just this, like it's a taboo and we're not supposed to talk about it, so let's learn about it and what's going on. And I was met time and time again by publishers, because I wanted to write a book about all these people I met in Germany. I went and met all these non-offending pedophiles or paedophiles, and I was just told that that same word came back every time, of revulsion. It's too much for people. People are not going to get this book because of the revulsion factor. Is that something that you come up against, or is that something you enjoy?
I think these topics, I've only ever delivered these talks really to skeptical groups. I consider myself a skeptic first and foremost, so I deliver them with skeptical groups who are interested in looking at topics in a skeptical way. And so, yeah, of course, there is revulsion, most definitely. These are topics that are grossly taboo and reviled around the world, although not universally. So definitely come up against that, yes. I try and handle the topics with some humour where appropriate, with some irreverence, because I feel like I can't discuss these topics really without having some irreverence and humour, because of their incredibly heavy nature. So come up against revulsion, but often find people are quite receptive once you start talking about them. I think people are quite interested about them.
I find the same thing with paedophilia, actually. People are like, no. But then once you talk, everyone get at the table will start talking and everyone gets really excited about it. And I think it's a similar thing here. I know that this episode on at least on YouTube I'm not going to be able to monetize it. Like, they go so funny on YouTube about like anything. So anyone that's mentioned like a terrorist, and anyone who's mentioned like it's a, which is a shame actually, because I guess the world will be a bit blander when you can't talk about these kinds of things.
I think one of the reasons that I'm so interested in the topics is specifically because people are reluctant to talk about them. That I feel like we are happy to examine all these parts of humanity and parts of ourselves, but not those bits. we won't examine those bits too carefully because they are so weird or so strange. And so it's precisely because of that that I want to look at them, really.
It's almost quite Victorian. It's like a hangover from the Victorian times, you know, just like, let's pretend those animalistic sides of ourselves don't exist. Let's start with maybe incest. What's going on with incest then? What would you typically in a talk about with incest? Are we talking about like siblings and parents? Cousins are not included. What's the deal with incest?
So you started with a topic that I've actually researched the least.
It's your new one, isn't it?
So this is the one that I'm currently in the middle of writing, yeah. So I'm not going to be able to speak too deeply on it, but essentially when I'm trying to tackle a subject that is so charged and, so taboo, that I start with looking at the animal kingdom usually. I try and put these behaviours in context with the ecosystem that we live within or have grown up amongst. And so with incest, I started looking at the existence of it in nature. So looking at consanguinity, looking at how in populations of animals you might have a certain amount of interbreeding between close relatives, that kind of thing.
What's co-sanguinity? Like blood's co-blood.
It's kind of like a way of measuring how much interbreeding is happening in a population. So how co-sanguine is a population? Start looking at what animals it might appear in, why it does appear, why it doesn't appear, that kind of thing. So for example, I found some examples of species where inbreeding, which is typically very detrimental for a species, it exists quite happily in, for example, mongoose, spotted salamanders, bedbugs, fruit flies, that kind of thing. They have some level of inbreeding tolerance, where essentially not too bad for them genetically, but generally inbreeding within animals is bad genetically, and leads to, there's a word for it, I'm still researching, but it leads to suppression basically. So that's where I normally start.
What, so that's fascinating. So the mongoose and what were the other animals? And they just exist okay like that?
Yeah, so most animals, it appears, there's a thing called inbreeding depression, that's what it's called, where it is detrimental genetically to have interbreeding between close relatives. However, there are some species where it appears that they have some tolerance to this, and that are those species that I've listed, mongoose, salamanders, bedbugs, that kind of thing. There are most likely more, but that's where I sort of started in the research. And then, of course, you go and look into things like inbreeding and incest within captive animals. So we obviously do this a lot with dogs and cats and with tigers and all sorts of zoo animals, that kind of thing. So starting with that level of inquiry and then moving on from there.
Is this happening in humans as well? I'm cautious that I know this is your newest topic, so I don't want to ask anything you haven't looked into. Are there places where incest among humans is acceptable?
Well, it certainly has been. So if we look at look throughout history, so I typically I'll go from looking at the zoology of a thing to looking at the history of it within humans. Certainly within royal families throughout sort of recorded history, there has been examples of incest and inbreeding. If you think of the way that we might practice incest and inbreeding in captive animals, so we might line breed in order to create a pedigree breed of a dog, for example, you would line breed them. So you sort of breed them with different members of their own lineage in order to keep the characteristics that you like. So for a dog, the way it looks or how it acts or something. Well, we've sort of done that. Sort of royal families have sort of done that to themselves at different points of human history. So having these examples where, because of an idea of purity or of superiority, a lot of royal families will line breed themselves so that they keep the bloodline within their own family, that kind of thing. So I've discovered that as well, and I find the analogy kind of like funny and kind of scary that we've sort of some humans have done that to themselves. So yeah,
pedigree monarchy.
Yeah, well, it's all about pedigree.
Oh my god, I never thought about like all the dogs that they're all incestuous, aren't they? And I suppose that doesn't matter because they're dogs and stuff.
You typically have worse health problems in pedigree dogs, for example, because of the amount of consanguinity that's in their population. So the amount, if you were to measure how closely they are relative to each other, they're all quite closely related. And so some like very beautiful and very common dogs like Labradors or Alsatians, that kind of thing, have quite major health concerns because of how pedigree breeding works and that they're often quite closely related to one another.
But that is the issue with incest generally, isn't it? It's the reason that we're probably evolutionarily not attracted to one another, our sisters and brothers and parents and whatever, is it's something to do with the genes, right? That it's too similar or something.
Yeah, and this is where I'm going to have to defer, really, because I've sort of done like my preliminary look over this stuff, but not gone too deeply into it. And also, I must preface maybe the whole discussion today with that I am not an evolutionary biologist or an evolutionary psychologist. My training is in history and anthropology, so I've not looked deeply enough into it, but there definitely is a thing as inbreeding depression, which means that typically in a species, if you were to do it over a long period of time or a lot, then they would result in health problems.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Let's move on to necrophilia, right? That's weird. And so Jimmy Savile sort of brought that, I think, to the mainstream in the UK for like Americans or non-Brits and stuff. That was like the most prolific paedophile or pedophile in the world ever or something like that. And he was a celebrity here and it was a big shock, although not so much of a shock to everyone. And there was, I don't even know if that's confirmed. Do you know about that with the Jimmy Savile stuff?
I don't. No, I've done no research into the man. And when I'm looking at these topics, I tend to avoid these celebrity cases, although of course we'll read about them, because I think that oftentimes they are these big, well-known cases because they are outliers and because they are these unusually you know, sordid or unusually prolific or unusually cruel examples of the thing. So no, I of course have heard those accusations and those things about Jimmy Savile, but I don't know anything about them. I don't know anything about them really.
What can you tell us about necrophilia?
Well, much like all the things we're going to talk about today, that it exists upon a spectrum. I think if we were to look at the three major topics that I've been able to look at with cannibalism, necrophilia, and bestiality, that they are actually, we have these ideas in popular culture that they are these monolithic behaviors, that they are this thing that someone can be or a behavior that someone can do, and actually that it exists over a huge wide range of things. So starting from where I normally like to start with Animal Kingdom, necrophilia is something that we observe in the animal kingdom, something that we observe throughout loads of different species and lots of different taxa and lots of different areas of the evolutionary tree, which is really fascinating. Probably one of the most famous examples of animal necrophilia is the case of the dead duck. Have you heard this?
No.
So there was a Dutch biologist called Kees Malijke, who was sitting in his office one day when he heard the thud of a bird hitting the glass of his building. And he went out to look, and he saw this bird lying dead on the floor, a duck. And next to it, another living duck who pecked at a duck for a bit and then mounted it and started to copulate with it. And then continued to do this for 75 minutes.
Wow.
Yeah. But the duck did take two short breaks in the middle, and it only ended because Malijke intervened. And this was an example.
After 75 minutes, he was like, I better intervene.
He was like, I should probably. I think he, because he is an expert in the Natural History Museum of Rotterdam. So I think he wanted to retrieve the body. Anyway, that was an example of homosexual necrophilia in ducks. And has earned him some reputation, earned him an Ig Nobel Prize for a paper that he wrote about it. And it's an example of Davian behavior. And Davian behavior is what necrophilia is called in the animal kingdom. That's like one like famous to some people example of Davian behavior.
What are these Ig Nobel awards?
So you have the Nobel awards, of course, but the Ig Nobel is these like fun and humorous awards that are awarded for people for doing weird research. So yeah, he won Ig Nobel. And also that day is called the Dead Duck Day. In that museum that they celebrate every year, and he brings out the stuffed duck.
Do ducks have like genitals? I mean, I guess everything has genitals, right? I can't imagine duck penis.
Ducks have spiral penises I think allows for like locking together during copulation. But like that's only some ducks, not all ducks. I even think all ducks have penises. Of course, female ones don't, but I think all male ducks have penises. It's not universal across birds at all.
Do fish have penises?
No, they don't.
I've never seen it. I'm just wondering. I never think about animals, and they have a lot of sex, don't they? Obviously,
they do, and a lot of the sex is very weird and very strange. And oftentimes, and with necrophilia, it is one of those unusual and strange behaviours. But nature is completely full of weird and strange sexual behaviours. Other examples in nature of necrophilia in animals, so cliff swallows have been observed to copulate with cliff swallows who have been killed by cars, male sea otters with dead female sea otters, red garter snakes with dead garter snakes. It happens sort of across the animal kingdom and has been observed in nature and in captivity. And it's sort of like a bunch of reasons why it might happen. There's also a really fascinating one, Andrew. Really fascinating example where it's a species of Amazonian toad called the Rhinella proboscidea, in which the males have been observed grasping the corpse of a dead female and manually squeezing the eggs out of them and fertilizing them as normal. Yeah. And so that's an example of functional necrophilia, where you'll have living offspring produced from a coupling of a dead and living partner.
Oh my God. I would want to like grab the frog and go like, mate, what are you doing?
He'd be like, no, it was a toad. Yeah. An Amazonian toad.
I would just go like, mate, no. You know, that's not consensual. Although I suppose, you know, like defamation doesn't exist when someone's dead.
No, I don't think in the case of necrophilia that consent is necessarily an issue. I think when it comes to humans, for example, there are, of course, there is ethical concerns riddled throughout all these things. But of course, in humans, even if the consent of the dead person is not a consideration, you know, the distress caused to family, loved ones, that kind of thing is a consideration. So,
like defamation as well, legally, just that it's a similar thing of like, you know, once someone's dead, that you can't defame them, but you can still cause, you can cause suffering to their family.
Interesting. I've never thought of that analogy.
Necrophilia and defamation. Defilation and defamation, I suppose you could call it. Defilation, defiling. God. And so, okay, so what you were saying before, I think that it's, while people want to categorize as like, this person's a necrophiliac and that's not, it's actually, is it more of a spectrum and like some people are more likely to do it?
Exactly, yeah. In fact, there's a 10-point scale for necrophiliacs, if you're interested in the 10-point scale. There's a professor called Anil Agrawal who's actually done research into both necrophilia and bestiality, who's a really great, really interesting resource in this kind of thing, who has classified necrophiles into 10 different classes, basically. And I can tell you them if you'd like. There's role players. There's people who don't actually want to have sex with dead people, but enjoy sex with living people who are pretending to be dead. You have romantic necrophiles who maybe remain attached to a dead person's body after they're dead because of grief or something like that. Yeah. Necrophilic fantasizers, people who may visit cemeteries or funerary parlors or may masturbate in the presence of the dead. Sorry, content warning for all this. I'm presuming, hopefully we'll put one at the beginning of the episode.
I'll do that at the beginning. I'll say to people, look, this is going to be horrific. So if you want, skip to the next episode. If you want to hear some horrific stuff, then listen to this.
To be clear, I think all this stuff is fascinating. And I do have a fascination with the macabre, but my interest is not in gawping or in sort of like staring lividly at these things. I am interested in finding the humanity of these things and finding how they fit into our understanding of ourselves. So I think, yeah, things are lurid, but I think they are interesting and are useful in our understanding of ourselves anyway.
Yeah. I suppose out of 7 billion people, though, as well, you've got to have some who've got different interests and things. But I mean, I guess most of us, I would like to think, with that sort of the revulsion, the ick factor involved in dead people. I mean, just being near a dead, that would shock me for just months, just seeing a dead person. I don't think I've ever...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, of
I
don't course.
Think, yeah, I might never have seen a dead person.
We are hugely divorced from death. Sorry, the conversation's going all over the place. But yeah, we are hugely divorced from death. We have very little connection with dead bodies or anything like that. So yeah, I think that... we'll get into this in a moment, but a lot of this actually happens within people who have frequent connection with dead bodies. So a lot of this happens with people in professions that are connected with the death industry, that kind of thing.
Well, that's also circular, isn't it? Because you might think, oh, somebody got involved in the death industry because they don't have the same revulsion around death.
Yeah, it's interesting. I don't know if we know the answer to that, whether it is that the... professions lead to more interest in dead bodies, or more interest in dead bodies leads to being in those professions. Yeah, I'm not entirely sure what way around that causation is.
What were the stats you were going to give?
Yeah, so there was a study in 1989 by Rosen and Resnick who reviewed 122 cases of necrophilia, and yeah, some of their findings. So 53% of the instances could be found in professions that allowed frequent access to corpses, such as mortuary and morgue attendants. So about half of them occurred in people who had this close connection. And then we have some stats on exactly what that necrophilia looks like in terms of what the actual acts are, as well as the motivations people have as well, if you'd be interested to hear.
Yes, please.
Right. Content warning. So in terms of the actual acts themselves, I think we think of necrophilia as a penetrative act, which appears to be about true about half of the time, maybe over half the time. So 51% of the acts in that 122 sample were vaginal intercourse. Then 29% were mutilation, 15% was kissing, 11% anal intercourse, 8%
Oh, kissing's worse.
8% fondling breasts, and 7% fellatio or cunnilingus.
Oh my God. Wait, so, okay, and does it say how many of these are men? It must be all men.
Yes, so the 95% of them were men.
Men are weird.
Men are weird, yes.
I wonder, how do they get these statistics? Like, who's volunteering that information?
So this is information, it's very hard to get information from this, but this study that was done in 1989 was cases from medical literature, legal literature, that kind of thing. So we should be very careful using the stats, because actually any stats that I tell you today are actually very hard to verify because of the nature of the topic, and because there's actually just not a huge amount of research into these areas. But we're sort of like reading the tea leaves, really, with this kind of research. So this was from medical and legal literature, basically. So we can probably say that some populations of necrophiles are underrepresented, and probably some are overrepresented. So times where it involves the legal system or the medical system are going to be overrepresented, rather than instances of necrophilia or necrophilic desires that doesn't ever involve the authorities. So fantasizers aren't in this bracket, aren't in these stats, you know, people who may consensually engage in role play, that kind of thing. That's how they gather the information.
I guess it's all statistics and just a huge amount of people. And I wonder if just, you know, thousands listen to this, there must be a few people listening now going, oh, that's me, that's my fantasy, but I won't. Whereas I think most people would be like, oh God, this is horrible.
Well, I think there are some fetishes and kinks that are related to necrophilia. There's sopophilia, I believe is the word, where it might be aroused by people who are asleep, or being aroused by someone having sex with you when you are asleep, that kind of thing. And that is sort of parallel or tangential to necrophilic sort of ideas or desires. Yeah, very possible that people in your audience may have had some kind of interaction with this kind of thing.
Do you think, are there cultures in the world where it's sort of more morally acceptable?
So with necrophilia, I wasn't able to find any evidence that there's sort of been culturally approved necrophilia. However, that is not entirely true, because I have found instances in history. So Hittite law from the 16th century BCE explicitly permitted sex with the dead. As well as with horses and mules, but I'm sure we'll get onto that.
Bloody hell. Like, it's weird to have that as a rule. They've actually put that in. Like, do you want to do that? So you're not saying it's like an absence of a law against it. It's actually a law saying you can do it.
Yeah, at least in the Hittites, yeah, in ancient history. But I've not been able to, unlike with cannibalism, I've not been able to find a civilization or a culture where it is casually practiced. However, having said that, remember that necrophilia is really a spectrum, and that intimacy with dead bodies is not unusual. You know, we have intimate interaction with dead bodies on a regular basis. You know, people who deal in the death industry have intimate interactions. You know, nurses probably right now are doing something called the last offices, which is where when someone dies, they have their body prepared. So their wombs are dressed, they are clothed, they are shaved, they are all that kind of stuff. On one side of the spectrum, there is this perfectly acceptable interaction with dead bodies that are relatively intimate, you know, even through to open caskets, and you might kiss a dead body on the forehead when you're burying them, or an open casket. And then it goes over to sort of more and more, you know, extreme examples of intimacy with dead bodies. Although we can't say, you know, as a matter of course, there is a culture where you can have sex with dead bodies, but there are certainly cultures where you have intimacy with dead bodies, definitely.
Man. And I guess most of us don't like that. I'm thinking about incest and And necrophilia. And I guess most of us have that revulsion. And I suppose if you look at incest and necrophilia, that's probably for good evolutionary reason, because being around dead bodies historically might have given you a lot of diseases and things like that, right?
Sorry, with necrophilia, yeah.
Yeah, so incest, we were talking about before, just with like, it's not good for the gene pool, is it? And then necrophilia, mm-hmm. I think it can, being around dead bodies and things, you're going to get illnesses.
Certainly, yeah. I think dead bodies carry that risk, especially with when they're of your own species, they carry the risk of disease, certainly. But some of these instances, we have some examples, modern examples of necrophilia. For example of a woman whose husband died of an asthma attack, and out of grief, she kept him in her bed for several weeks. I think it's not always... Sometimes these are examples of people who are going through extreme grief, or people who have experienced extreme trauma or extreme abuse, who turn to dead bodies for intimacy. There's some really fascinating ideas about how dead bodies are actually quite a safe people to interact with, because there's no danger of rejection, there's no danger of pain, there's no danger of abuse, that kind of thing. So yeah, I mean. We're only talking for an hour, but there's so much. There's such deep and complex topics, and I could talk to them. We could talk about them for every one. We could talk about them for hours.
Oh yeah, I almost feel like I wonder if we should have done. We could do like two of these over an hour, and then do another two another time. But I don't know. I want to get into all of them, I suppose. With cannibalism, right? Is that one where? So those first two, as I say, I think like there must be some reason why a lot of us don't want to be involved in those, because I think there's illnesses and diseases and genetic problems. Cannibalism, is human meat poison? What's the deal?
Great question, because this is actually how I started researching cannibalism, because I was in a seminar in university, and we were researching, we were learning about human evolution, and some of the earliest human bones that we have in existence of anatomically modern human beings have evidence of cannibalism on them. So they have cut marks, which is these striations of marks where flesh has clearly been removed from the bones. And one of the explanations for this is cannibalism. Another idea could be funerary defleshing, where you remove flesh from the bones and then bury the bones separate from the flesh. Anyway, one of the possible ideas is cannibalism. And when we were learning about this in the lesson, one of my peers said, but human meat is poisonous. And I was like, in my head, I was like, that isn't right, surely. And so I was like, because I knew about survival cannibalism, you know, heard about people surviving on human meat, you know. So I was like, that can't be right, surely. So I went away and looked into it and found out that no, it's not poisonous. And came back to the lesson the next week. And I was like, no. And I was like, have my papers ready. I was like, not poisonous. Here is the evidence. And that's when I decided that I was going to research it more deeply, because I found it so fascinating. But no, human meat is not poisonous. It is the same as any other meat. There are some unique dangers, so for example, diseases, etc. But really, they are really quite rare if you cook the meat properly and it's from a healthy individual. There shouldn't be much danger at all. But I do think I have an idea about where the idea came from, about it being poisonous, if you'd like to hear my idea. It comes from Papua New Guinea. So there is a group of people in Papua New Guinea called the Four People, and that's F-O-R-E, not just Four People. And they are a group, they are a civilization who, as part of their reverence for the dead, would eat their dead loved ones. And this is something called endocannibalism, or funerary ritual cannibalism. This is where, out of love and affection, you'll eat someone after they die. And in the Four community, it was the women who ate their bodies. And in their religion, they ate everything. They ate the skin, the bone, the hair, the feces, the spine, the brain, everything. And really fascinatingly, in the Four society, the women were the grave. If you can imagine that, and what happened was they were quite happily living their lives and practicing their religions and having their civilization, and then they began to die, and that is because of a prion disease, which is a misfolded protein in the brain, basically, or misfolded protein in the body, which only could have been carried passed on to somebody else, really, through ingestion of the brain or spinal column. People would have, when you have this misfolded protein, you have tremors and shaking, sporadic outbursts of laughter, an eventual and inevitable death, and it's called Kuru, and it's an incurable, fatal, degenerative neurological disorder, similar to mad cow disease. And it's because of the way that the four people practice their ritual funerary rituals, it spread like wildfire through the four community. Because whenever someone died of it, they would eat them, which was of course passed on to somebody else.
Oh no!
Yeah, exactly. Which is really tragic. And they think that it may have originated from just a single individual in that community. And I think that instead of this sort of like tragic story reaching the rest of the world, what the bit that reached the rest of the world is cannibalism drives you mad and kills you, which just isn't true. It's that Kuru can kill you, but it is passed on through cannibalism, but it is incredibly rare. So yeah, that's where it may have came from, that idea that it's poisonous.
Yeah, that's so strange. And I guess Papua New Guinea is the one, I think, isn't it, that people know about. If you hear about cannibalism, you think Papua New Guinea. And I guess maybe there's this sort of, because I didn't know it was done as this sort of funerary process, you know, I thought it was, because I guess maybe you could even say racist comic books from back in the day would sort of portray them catching people and boiling them up and all that kind of thing.
Oh, totally. Oh, you've hit upon a really fascinating area of study with cannibalism, and it is rife with racism. And in fact, even the word cannibalism is a racist term, because it comes from Christopher Columbus sailing over to the Americas and reaching the Americas, and then being told by the natives that he met about this cannibalistic tribe called the Caribs. And this word has then become Carib or cannibalism, and has become part of our language to mean man eating or people eating. And Christopher Columbus then used that accusation of cannibalism as justification to enslave and murder and rape and pillage the entire of the indigenous communities that he met. And to this day, you know, cannibalism is this accusation of savagery, you know, that happens in these far-flung non-white parts of the world, you know, when actually cannibalism was practiced in Europe up until the 1900s. It's fascinating. So you could buy human meat from a German pharmaceutical company up until 1908. There's something called mummia. So there's the idea that bits of mummies or dried out mummy flesh from Egypt. There's this idea that it can cure ailments, you know, all sorts of ailments, including epilepsy, that kind of thing. And mummy was very popular in Europe for a long time, and only stopped being sold, like I say, in the previous century. And the demand for mummia was so strong that they stopped using mummies in the end because they couldn't get a hold of them. So they start using the dried flesh of criminals and other people in society.
Oh my God. I don't know. Why doesn't the world know this already?
There are many cultures in our history that practiced cannibalism in, you know, a societally accepted way. And I think the reason why it is taboo now is actually a really fascinating question, and not one that I have a real answer for, because it makes some evolutionary sense as well. When you look at it in nature, you do see it in nature a lot. It often makes some evolutionary sense when you are faced with a resource like a dead body. If it is it may be advantageous to eat a dead body and gain that nutrients than to leave it. You also have it in lots of different species, like mantises. You know, stick insects will frequently, the female will eat the male during or after sex, which is called sexual cannibalism. It's also technically necrophilia, which is also kind of cool.
Oh yeah, so it's still like dying while being, it's still while having sex.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
what must that feel like to be in the stick insect's head in that moment?
I can't imagine. It's very nice, although I can't say that I know what it's like to be a sick insect, so maybe they enjoy it. I don't know.
Weird. I guess it's just like, well, this is what I do.
Gerbils, really, really, really fascinating example of cannibalism. Female gerbils. Gerbils are herbivores. Sorry, but female gerbils will indiscriminately eat baby gerbils that aren't their own until they have offspring of their own, and the hormone to not eat baby gerbils then kicks in.
That is mad. I mean, so the stigma you talked about with the word cannibalism, I noticed that because I interviewed one of the survivors of the plane crash from Uruguay to Chile, and they crashed in the Andes and they had to eat one another. And he said that when he, you know, they got out after 3 months, it was the most horrible thing that's ever happened to anyone ever, I think. I can't think of a more horrible survival story. And then they had like newspaper articles with the words like cannibals, cannibalism written. And he uses the word necrophagy. So is that any different?
Yeah, necrophagy, I think, is a good word. Well, necrophagy, you know. But of course, we all engage in necrophagy all the time, you know, if you eat meat, because you are eating of dead flesh. I think anthropophagy is also a good word, eating of oneself, anthropophagy, phagy. So yeah, I can see the uses of that word, most certainly. And of course, survival cannibalism is one of the types of cannibalism that we're most familiar with, because nowadays we don't really have many societies in the world who do practice cannibalism anymore, although there do appear to be a couple who still exist that still practice cannibalism in sort of more wild areas of the world.
Wow. That is interesting. I think because I have, that's part of why, so I went vegetarian, and the reason for that wasn't a moral one, because I'm just utterly immoral, I think. But it was more of maybe there was some morality in it, but it was more that ick factor. And I think I've got a very strong ick factor with stuff like dead, although I can listen to it all day and talk about it. And I enjoy that. I find it quite exciting to talk about. But that was it. I started, I'm interested that you said that eating animal flesh is like necrophagy, because it is eating dead flesh. And I think that's what put me off more than anything. I never was comfortable with it. And not because it's like I'm more moral than other people, but because it was like, ugh, dead animal now in my... And now I don't even know. You know, they talk about if they're gonna make... animal meat like from scratch and the DNA and stuff like that, it's still sort of like dead flesh, isn't it? Is that, I don't know if I'd still feel icky about eating that. Do you know what I mean?
Interesting. Yeah, I think I had a realization a few years ago. I think I was in the process of eating something and I just had this sudden realization that when you eat things, they go inside you. It's something that when you sort of start to think about too deeply, it becomes quite unusual and quite strange and perturbing. So yeah, I can totally see that. Yeah, I am veggie and definitely get this ick factor from meat personally. Yeah.
Yeah, and the only reason I'm not vegan is because I just tell myself not to think about it enough. And you just like, if something's got egg in it, just don't think about it, just have it. But really, I was going to have something with eggs the other day, and a friend of mine said, oh yeah, that's a sort of dead fetus or something in your mouth. You're enjoying that. Like, he was winding me up. And I couldn't eat eggs for another few weeks. Now I can eat them, but I have to not think about it.
Yeah, I think that... also, you get whenever you're using animal products, there is like an inherent ick factor if you think about it too deeply. I think you're right. Yeah. Maybe that comes on to bestiality in some ways, because you're sort of discussing sort of use of animals. Maybe that's a good place to go to. I don't know.
Such a good segue, except I haven't yet asked what human meat tastes like.
Oh, great question. So actually, there's a lot of debate over this. And there are two camps, as far as I can tell. There aren't really two camps. I've just gone lots of research and found two main themes, basically. And the first is that it tastes like pork. Now, that's probably one that you've probably heard, or probably one that your viewers have heard. And there's some good evidence for that. What a really famous example of modern cannibalism is the case of Armin Mivis. He was a German software technician who killed and ate his guest, Bernd Brandis. And it was a case, it was quite unique because it was a case of voluntary cannibalism because Burr and Brandis wanted to be eaten. But after Mivis killed Brandis, he kept his meat in a freezer and ate it for many months afterwards, ate around 20 kilograms of it. And he describes it as, here's a quote, "The flesh tastes like pork, a little more bitter, stronger. It tastes quite good." Mivis is obviously now in prison. He has since become a vegetarian. There are other people who have, there's other examples of people saying it tastes like pork. There's another person, there's a man called William Beulah Seabrook, and he was a journalist from the New York Times in the early 20th century. He was fascinated with the concept of eating human meat, and he convinced a intern at the University of Paris to give him a chunk of human meat from a body of a healthy man killed in an accident. And he provides quite a detailed description of it. He says, "It was like good, fully developed veal, not young, but not yet beef. It was so nearly like good, fully developed veal that I think no person with a palate of ordinary, normal sensitiveness could distinguish it from veal. It was mild, good meat with no other sharply defined or highly characteristic tastes, such as, for instance, goat, high game, or pork."
Okay, I've never had veal, but I'm imagining it being a bit chewy.
Well, funny you should say that, because there was a very modern example in the last few years of, there was a man in New Mexico who lost his foot in a motorcycle accident and then decided to eat it with his friends in... He had them in tacos.
What a nutter!
Well, I don't know. I think I actually spoke to him. I spoke to him over Reddit, and he seemed perfectly lucid and charming, and he was a very interesting person to talk to. He said it tastes like buffalo but chewier, super beefy with little fat.
But that's foot, then, isn't it?
It is foot. So it's really hard to say. I think because humans have lots of different diets, and all these cuts are all different, so it's really hard to say, but probably somewhere between pork and beef.
Well, that's another good segue, isn't it, to go into bestiality or bestiality. Who's Kenneth Pinion?
Kenneth Pinion was a man who died after having sex with a male horse, with a stallion. And the reason we know about Kenneth Pinion is because he was dropped off at a hospital in Washington, in a place called Emmonclaw. Let me see if I can find the information for this one. But he died as a result of that from a perforated colon. And that actually, it's revealed this case of, which became known quite infamously as the Emmonclaw horse sex case. And it was where they raided the farm that he came from, and they seized hundreds of hours of videotapes of men engaging in bestiality. They revealed a whole operation there.
So maybe he was at it quite often and it was all right, but that particular time he got a perforated colon.
Yeah, it seemed that they'd been engaging in it for a long time. Interestingly, the most severe crime anyone was charged with for that case was trespassing, because there was no law against it at the time in that area of America, in that part of America. So afterwards, laws were swiftly made. But in that case, in that instance, all they were charged with was trespassing.
I remember, because I used to live in Colombia, and I remember reading a lot about and seeing videos about, you know, and I would wind up my Colombian friends with this, because obviously very, very few engaged, you know, they don't even know about it, most of these people. But they're out in like the middle of nowhere. There seemed to be this culture of losing one's virginity. Men would lose their virginity to a donkey.
Right, okay, interesting. And was this like a myth, or is this an actual sort of...
No, it's a thing, because Vice did a little video about it, and they find a guy who's going to do it, and he sort of goes behind a barn and carries it out while they're filming. You sort of see a bit of him.
Interesting. Yeah, so when I... interestingly, maybe that ties in a little bit with some of the sort of stats that I was able to find on this in terms of the prevalence of... bestiality in humans, is that there was like some research done which had the different animals and the prevalence of each of those animals. According to a 2002 survey of 93 zoophiles, cows and dogs seem to be the most common animals, but as well as horse, sheep, cows, snakes, pigs, dogs and chickens all were part of the study. And it seems that they are animals that people have most access to. So it sounds like maybe in that instance there was a lot of access to that kind of animal, and so then bestiality with that sort of animal, perhaps.
If you're fucking a chicken, you've got to look at your life, I think, and go, you know, how has it led to this?
Yeah, I think that yeah, I think you do. There's nothing I can really say to that one. No, I think you're right that it there is nowhere, is no like in contrast to cannibalism, there's doesn't seem to be any culture in the world where that is sort of accepted as a part, as just part of the culture. Although it does seem to be pockets sort of in certain cultures or in pockets in history. For example, we go back to the Hittites that we mentioned earlier. They explicitly allowed sex with horses and mules. So sometimes they're also with oxen and pigs, but only if they approached you.
Right, if they approach you.
Yeah.
For sex, but you, how could you prove that in a court of law?
Yeah, well, no, I'm not sure that you can. I think although obviously you say it in jest, is an interesting, at least maybe an interesting discussion about consent in animals, which when I was studying this topic, of course, came up, and like whether, you know, the ethics and everything else of bestiality. And so it's like, you know, can an animal approach you? Can animal consent? And it was really fascinating to look into, because I think that animals are capable of some level of consent. You know, I think animals move away when they don't want something, or move towards you with when they want something, you know, broadly. And I think it's a little bit anthropocentric to say that only humans who are able to speak have any level of consent. But I think largely the idea of consent, I think, is a bit moot in the discussion of the ethics of bestiality. Because even if I think even if you had an animal that you could 100% declare, yes, animal has consented to something, ultimately there is a insanely big power differential between you and the animal in terms of context, capacity, idea, idealization, etc., that I think it is always integrally immoral.
I've heard these stories about, like, you know, people doing that. They've sort of been having sex with the dog, and usually it's a case of, like, they've been, you know, abusing the children, and the house is a horrible mess, and, you know, it's just a whole horrible state, and also they were sexually abusing the dog or whatever, and the dog sort of cowering in the corner. And I just thought, well, the dog wouldn't respond the way we do to sort of molestation, would it? Or maybe it would, but it doesn't have the same sort of ideas and concepts of what that means.
Mm-hmm, exactly, which I think is why, like, bestial interactions just are necessarily abusive and immoral. But yeah, I think you're right. It just doesn't have the same comprehension of context or ideas. I'm very aware that with the nature of our conversation sort of going lots of different directions, that there are lots of concepts that we're not talking about, and lots of ideas and examples that we're not talking about that also exist. But yeah, I mean, undoubtedly examples can exist in an abusive situation, certainly.
I got a great question from Matt from Bristol Humanist, he's the one who put me on to you. So shout out to Matt. And he wants to know about viral infections among hunter-gatherers, because he's heard that they only began when we invented farming, viral infections in humans, and by having sex with livestock started to spread, and there weren't sort of pandemics and things like that before that.
So there is such a thing, they're called zoonoses. And they are diseases that can be transmitted from animals to humans. And so over 200 zoonoses have been identified, so bacteria, parasites, fungi, viruses, etc. The most dangerous being things like rabies, that kind of stuff. In terms of, viral infections and no pandemics before agriculture, I think that from my understanding, it is typically the eating of animals and eating of game and the eating of wild animals that has caused a lot of the major viruses of the 21st of the last few hundred years. For example, HIV was from eating wild game and eating chimpanzees, etc. So I think, from what I understand, I think the eating of animals is a greater source of viruses than having sex with them.
That's really interesting.
Well, things like rabies, that kind of thing, are probably the greatest dangers. Wikipedia does mention some more dangers, such as allergic reactions. Some people have anaphylaxis to animal semen, for example, and you can just get other trauma, bites, trampling, that kind of thing.
That's really interesting, because I think for so long the assumption was that with like HIV, there was sex with a monkey at some point. You know, it's a source of like a lot of stand-up comedy, isn't it? I'm sure Ricky Gervais has done that at some point. It's interesting to know, oh, it might have just been eating that animal.
A homophobic myth, you know. I think that a disease that initially primarily affected the homosexual population, and so was by many people at the time of the HIV pandemic, you know, welcomed by homophobes and welcomed by bigots. And even more pernicious rumours started about it, when really I think the reality is far more interesting and complex than any kind of homophobic myth.
Do animals have sex with other different animals?
Yes, most certainly. So we have examples all across the animal kingdom. So yeah, it's kind of one of the things that I'd like maybe listeners to go away with is that these behaviours exist. All of them exist in the animal kingdom as well, and exist on this big spectrum. And fascinating stuff. So, for example, there's a recent BBC article called "Japanese Monkey Tries to Mate with Deer," and that is an example of these interactions between monkey and deer on this Japanese island. There's examples of sea lions with penguins, otters with seals, deer with ostriches, bears, like dogs with tigers, just all sorts of things. There's loads of interactions. Also, animals will use other animals to masturbate with. So, an example, there's like videos you can find of chimpanzees using frogs to masturbate with, and all sorts of things.
What are they doing with the frogs?
So there is just evidence in captivity, I should say, in captivity of chimpanzees using frogs to masturbate with, as well as other things to masturbate with, such as banana peels and all sorts.
Like a dead frog?
I don't know. I think it might be dead afterwards. I'm not entirely sure.
What a way to go.
Yeah, certainly. There is also, interestingly, when it comes to bestiality, in the animal kingdom, it's not always a negative thing per se, because you can have hybrids when two species can hybridize to make an entirely new species. And this is an integral part of evolution in many ways. You have some examples, actually. There's certain types of fish that hybridize. So European flounders and European plaice hybridize. That is a particularly common in the Western Baltic Sea. You have three quarters of British duck species hybridized with another species of duck. And in fact, 10% of all animal species on Earth are involved in hybridization. It is a part of evolution, which, when you think of it as, you know, animal bestiality, as it were, it's really fascinating to start thinking about. Even dolphins, there's even a mammal where it's hybridized. So the climbing dolphin is a hybridized species between a spinner dolphin and a striped dolphin. It's now produced an entirely new species.
What's a mule? Is that something like that?
Mule is, I think, isn't it a male horse and a female donkey, I think? And then you think the other way, there's a name for it the other way around as well, when it's a male donkey and a female horse. I can't remember what that's called. Oh, it's an ass, isn't it? So it's a mule and an ass, depending on which one's the father and which one's the mother.
Is there anything, because we have skipped like crazy over, it's like four things that all worthy of their own podcast, and I've gone like skipping that. Is there anything like in there that you were like, oh, that would have been really interesting, and we haven't touched on it?
Well, I think to stick with bestiality, if you think about it as interspecific mating, so mating between different species, I think it's worth noting that this has played a major part in our own evolution. In a study of our own genetic evolution, we have the Neanderthal Genome Project, which showed that 1-4% of DNA from all living people, apart from most sub-Saharan Africans, is of Neanderthal heritage, and that humans interbred with Neanderthals, Denisovans, and at least one other extinct Homo species. So there is interbreeding, and you know, we're using bestiality in this way to mean sex between two different species, but there is bestiality in our own evolution. And then when you start to broaden this definition and look at it as a spectrum, it is really fascinating. So I think it's something worth knowing.
Yeah, that is fascinating. What a weird thing Imagine what like Pornhub would be now with like all these different species of human or like different kinds of humans and stuff like that. It'd be mad.
There was a time in human history where there were several. It's amazing to think about. There was a time in human history not too long ago where there were several. There were several distinct human species living on the Earth at the same time. Isn't that wild? And that it wasn't entirely combative. There was interbreeding.
And imagine that. It's like you can't even imagine it now without it becoming like in your mind some sort of ranking, like hierarchical system that would just be awful for everyone.
Yeah, it's speculation to think about what happened there, but fascinating to think about. There's actually a word for it which I quite like. There's a word from, if you're a sci-fi person, but there's Larry Niven, really giant in the sci-fi sphere, who wrote the Ringworld saga, and there's a book called The Ringworld Throne, and in that he coins the word reshathra, and that is defined as a sexual practice outside one's own species but within the intelligent hominids.
Right.
So in his instance, he's talking about aliens, but I think the word kind of pertains to ourselves, so I think we've had some reshathra in our own history.
I'm thinking of that Island of Dr. Moreau. Is that what it was called, the book? I read that years ago.
I've not read it, personally.
You might have seen the Simpsons episode.
I have, yes. Yeah. That is probably... So many of my cultural touchstones come from the Simpsons.
So me too. And they're all like, yeah, Simpsons characters, but becoming animals. Anyway, that's a great book. Yeah, I mean, the last question on this, I just want to know, like, I mean, are you ever worried? I worry sometimes when I write about the pedophilia stuff that people will sort of associate me with that. And do you know what I mean? You don't want to become that guy. Do you ever worry about that? Do you ever get sort of emails and anger and stuff like that?
No, I don't. And maybe because of my relative obscurity, which is fine. I think that... Also, the audiences often that I'm speaking to, I think, are open to discussing these kind of topics in a sceptical way. But I think broadly, no, I'm not worried. I'm quite open about my fascination into these things. And I guess it's just part of me intellectually and what I find fascinating. And so I try not to shy away from that. I think with certain topics, you know, like pedophilia, it's something that I would like to investigate one day. And I think maybe part of, doing these things, I think will help me look critically and skeptically at other topics. And so I do intend one day to have an investigation similar to my investigation into these taboos and revolting things, into pedophilia itself. And that I would worry about most certainly because of its rawness, because of its tabooness, because of its, you know, its cruelty, etc. It would be a very sensitive topic to try and talk about.
The prevalence of it, because it's very unlikely that you are into sort of incest and bestiality and all that stuff, whereas it's percentage-wise, there are a lot of pedophiles, so...
Yeah, with these topics that I'm looking at, they are broadly very rare. Probably the most common one is most likely bestiality of the things we talked about today. You know, we haven't been able to go through all the stats and research today, but most likely the most common. And, you know, we talk about their existence in animal kingdom and existence in humans, but broadly not super relevant, although there are relevancies to modern day. But I think that pedophilia is very much in the current consciousness. And even in political discourse, you know, there's discussion of pedophilia. So, yeah, I think that would be a very difficult one to tackle, I think.
What a thrill that was. As I said at the start, I do hope it wasn't too much for some of you. I can imagine that many of you had your ick senses triggered and may not have even got this far. For those of you who stuck around, which is all of you listening, obviously, I'm glad you did, and I hope you learned a lot from James, who you can email and write to and chat to on Cannibal Skeptic with a K, the skeptic, cannibalskeptic@gmail.com. Thanks again to Matt from Bristol Humanists for suggesting James as a guest. He really was a perfect guest for making for a great episode. Thanks to my girlfriend, Hawley, for continuing to edit this podcast so beautifully. I hope she didn't mind listening to that one. To hear our bonus chat with James, that is, me and James, sign up on patreon.com/AndrewGold. You'll get early access to episodes as well. Please keep sharing with friends and reviewing. I think reviewing helps with stats or something. Here's a really long and beautiful and complimentary one from Team Fabian in the US, who left 5 stars on Apple.
you are going to need a bigger boat. Here is how you know you have hooked a whale. I listened to Andrew Gold and the Jordan Harbinger show discussing exorcisms. My 12-year-old daughter, who has been passively listening to true crime podcasts her whole life and actively ignores dismembering, methed up serial killer cases, turns her head and states, "Who is this guy? This is really interesting." I told her, and I assumed she would forget about it, considering forgetting what your mother said is a full-time job in junior high. I nearly spit my coffee all over the dash the next time I had Jordan show on. From the back, she pipes up, "Where's the other guy, Gold? Put him on." So I'm reviewing a 50-year-old former criminal investigating, psychiatric counselling, currently graphic design teaching, single mum, and her 12-year-old pink hair sporting, M&M smuggling, drama dodging daughter. We agree on this. This is a top podcast for really real. I listened to Serial as it aired, having been a This American Life streamer for years. I can spot a player. I've seen the field grow from a rotation of three to the boom it has become. Everyone will know Gold's name soon enough, but for bragging rights, I thought I would post that June Fabian called it first in Boston, Massachusetts. Wow. What a review. I've never had one quite that interesting and beautifully written and everything. Thank you so much to the team Fabian, to both of you. I can't believe some of the stuff your 12-year-old daughter's listening to. I love the M&M smuggling because I do a lot of that as well. Something I'm constantly in trouble with my girlfriend for is eating all the M&Ms. The other day we actually brought home some Alfa Whores, which are chocolate with dulce de leche inside from Argentina. And within a week I'd eaten them all and she wasn't very happy with me. So also, I'm doing a public apology. I am sorry about that. And I knew it was bad as I did it and I still did it. But I must say, yeah, June, Fabian, and your daughter, I believe, June, you are the mother. Much love to you and your daughter. You guys got some good taste. Your job sounds fascinating too, I must say. Very cool. And I hope you guys are listening for many years to come. Really impressed that your daughter's listening to all these podcasts and stuff. She sounds cool. I should say something in American. Thank you for listening. And I can't do it. Boston. Boston, that's how Matt Damon and Ben Affleck sound. I've never been there, but it's supposed to be beautiful. I'm a cop. That's sort of Boston, isn't it? I'm a cop from Boston. No, can't do it. One day someone will teach me how to do accents. Thank you again for that review. That's all for this episode, but see you in a few days for my episode with Mustafa Kazemi, veteran war correspondent from Afghanistan.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.